Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking to Gary Bernhardt. Now, Gary is it was interesting because I got introduced to him through Corey Haynes, and we didn't really talk about software craftsmanship, but we did talk a lot about some of the things that are related to that, you know, as far as knowing your text editor, knowing your tools, just getting to be better. There's not a central theme that I can really put my finger on, but it was a great conversation, and you know, just some great things we talked about. So, you know, I'm going to turn that over in a minute, but before we get going, I need to mention our podcast sponsor. We have New Relic. New Relic RPM is a terrific application management tool that you can use in Ruby, Java, .NET, PHP. I mean, you name it, they pretty much will hook into it. And they give you real-time stats on your application and how it's performing. I've actually been using it quite a bit to optimize my one of my clients' applications. They turned on a free pro level subscription for 2 weeks for all of their customers, and it just happened to coincide with when this particular client was interested in having their site optimized. So I said, hey, look, let's take advantage of this. Let's run with it. Let's get some stuff optimized, and you know, hopefully we can move ahead with it. So anyway, it's just been super. It's been so nice because I get a full stack trace. I get a list of all of the database queries that are made. I get information on how long the response took to return to the client, where all the time was spent as far as in code as well. I mean, it's just so nice. So go check them out at newrelic.com. Now, I know I went a little long on that, and I apologize, but, you know, I've just been really impressed with their tool. Anyway, let's get to the interview, and I'll pick you up on the other end.
Hey, everybody. This is Charles Max Wood with Teach Me to Code, and this week I'm talking to Gary Bernhardt. Gary is pretty well known for his website, Destroy All Software. He's also been featured on a play-by-play video with Jeffrey Grossenbach at Peak Code, and he's also been pretty well known for his contributions to the Python and Ruby community, especially with the Python versus Ruby battle to the death. People know him for a bunch of other things, and we'll jump into those. But welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Thanks, man. It's awesome to be on.
These are always fun, and it's nice when somebody like Corey Haynes will introduce me to somebody else who's interesting, and I get to start looking into who they are and find out, oh, wow, this guy's pretty smart. So we'll jump right in here. I'm a little curious just to get started. How did you get started in programming? Is it something you've kind of always done, or did somebody introduce you to it?
It was my own direction. No one really drove me into it. And I started fairly late, I think, like maybe 13 or so. And it was sort of a very standard, boring story that everybody likes to tell, but nobody really likes to hear. Like QBasic, Visual Basic, MIRC scripting, then Quake mods, and then off into real software.
Isn't that other stuff real software?
Real software can be built in Visual Basic for sure. I would not call QBasic or IRC scripting real software.
All right, that's kind of interesting. So I'm a little curious. I watched your video Python versus Ruby, and I thought it was really interesting because it seemed like there were a lot of things that you wouldn't say didn't like, but that you didn't like as much in Ruby as you did in Python. But then I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that some of the features of Ruby are what allow it to do some of the things that you did like that the Ruby community had. Do you want to just go into that a little bit? I'm a little curious as to what in particular you didn't like. I did watch the video, but, you know, maybe for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. It has been a year and a half now since that talk, so things have changed a little bit. But basically, coming from Python, coming from 4.5 years of Python only at that point, I learned Ruby. I had a client that was a Rails shop, so I was deeply embedded in it for about 6 months before I did that talk. And there are so many things in Ruby where it just feels sloppy to a Python programmer. Things like arrays and hashes returning nil by default, and just all this syntax that is just multiple ways to say the same thing, so it's not strictly needed, which to a Python programmer says it shouldn't be there.
Right.
Just all the bigness of Ruby. It's a very large language syntactically, and just the sort of feeling of sloppiness of it. But like you said, that's exactly what allows RSpec to happen, because if you needed parens around every call, then every RSpec block would be much, much uglier and more clumsy to work with. So it's a tremendous source of strife in my life, really, this tension between the simple design of Python and the larger design of Ruby.
Interesting. Now, it sounds like you've done some things with Rails and a few other frameworks. What's your opinion on the frameworks that you find in Ruby versus the ones you find in Python?
Python, the Ruby ones are much, well, I've not really worked with anything other than Rails and Ruby, but just contrasting Rails to the Python mega frameworks, which basically means Django and TurboGears and Pylons now, Rails is much better designed, in my opinion. And it took me a long time to admit that, because in many ways it's more sloppily designed, but it's also more holistically designed. The pieces fit together better than the pieces in Django. Even though a lot of times Django has better fundamentals, its overall execution doesn't fit together the way the pieces of Rails fit together very nicely. I think that's just true of TurboGears or the other big Python frameworks.
Interesting. So are you a freelance developer, or how would you classify your job?
I do freelance development work. I usually use the word consultant, but I'm not the bad kind of consultant. people pay me money to build software. my longer-term goal, of course, is for Destroy All Software to be my whole job. Right now, I'm doing 2 days a week dedicated to Destroy All Software, and the other 3 days, I'm at a client doing contract work.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And what kinds of topics do you cover on Destroy All Software?
It's a pretty big mix. It's anything from sort of dynamic language stuff to test-driven development, object-oriented design, using Unix effectively. I've done only one on Vim, but a few more will probably come along. It's sort of just everything I feel competent enough in that I can talk about it to other people without feeling like I'm lying or posturing or something.
Right. And it seems like you have a relatively large community of people that, you know, interact with you and know who you are. I'm a little curious, too, as to how that came about, because, for example, with what I've done, you know, I put out a set of screencasts and a podcast and things like that, and that's how I've built the community that I interact with. But it doesn't seem like you have a lot of that. Mm. Or did I just miss it?
No, you're right. Until Python versus Ruby, I didn't do much of anything that was sort of an artifact that people would come to. I mean, a few blog posts that gained like several thousand hits, but nothing that's just huge and crazy. Uh-huh. I think it's been just very slow and just meeting people. A lot of them are people I've met in person. I used to go to like every user group in Cleveland, and then I moved to Seattle and went to every user group here. You just meet a lot of people doing that, and conferences and all that stuff. So I think it's been much more organic and personal than a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's hard to say, because I have nothing to compare with. I've only seen my own interactions with people.
I think we all suffer from that. So, you know, it is something that's interesting. Now, I didn't get a chance to watch the Peep Code. What exactly did you guys do on the video there?
So that was part of the first in a new Peep Code series called, why am I forgetting the name of it?
Play by Play.
Play by Play, yes. So it was the first one, and basically the idea is Jeff sits down with a developer who's very good at using his tools and his language and everything, and we build something. And along the way, we talk about why we're doing things the way we are, all the little details that are missed when you write a blog post or even record your own screencast. Mm-hmm. Because Jeff was sitting next to me the whole time, and he would say, why did you do that? Why did you do that? What does that mean? how did you get from this place to this other place in two keystrokes where it wasn't obvious? So basically what we do is build a little piece of Ruby code and make a lot of mistakes and do all kinds of things wrong, most of which get fixed by the end. But the point is to talk about how we're building software, how we're using the tools, how we're using the language, and get a deeper understanding of what we're doing rather than just sort of the polished abstract description that you get when you intentionally create something for publication to people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an awesome idea, and it was part of the reason that I ended up doing my own screencast site.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm a little curious then as to which tools you use.
Right. So I use Vim is my text editor. I also used Emacs for several years before Vim, so I've used both of the one true text editors. And my language of choice at this point is Ruby, although it was Python for many years. Git is my version control system whenever I can. I used to use Mercurial back in my Python days and talk lots of nasty things about Git, and now I tend to talk more nasty things about Mercurial. And that's basically my tool set. Of course, Unix, all of Unix, all the couple hundred utilities that make it up.
Right. So I want to dig in a little bit then on which libraries you use in Ruby. You know, for you brought up TDD. I'm assuming you're using RSpec because you brought that up.
Yeah.
You know, have you jumped in and used Cucumber or any of the others? Are there some that you favor better than others?
I love RSpec. I've been using it for the whole time. I've been using Ruby even before I was even able to call myself a Ruby programmer. I was already using RSpec. For full stack stuff, I do use Cucumber today, although I've had an off and on relationship with it. A lot of times I've had problems getting it to work with the huge stack of gems it requires. It's getting easier now. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you can basically install Cucumber and Capybara and kind of everything will probably work. So nowadays, for full stack testing, I do Cucumber to Capybara WebKit, which is a pretty new driver for Capybara that does in-process WebKit, so it does not open a browser application at all, which I've been waiting for like 5 years, and finally it's actually stable. So I highly recommend that.
I'll have to check that out. In fact, I'm going to write it down right here.
Yeah. I think it's pretty new, and I think it's from the Thoughtbot guys, but I've had no problems whatsoever. It's quite fast, and yeah, very good.
All right, so I also wonder then, since you used Python primarily before and then Ruby primarily now, was there any point that you felt like you made the switch or any reason you feel like you had, or was it just kind of, well, I found more Ruby clients than Python clients, or I'm kind of curious there.
The work I've been doing in terms of work for money has been back and forth the entire time. In fact, I just... My most recent Python client was only 2 months ago or so. But the thing is, slowly over these 2.5 years that I've been sort of transitioning, I've gone from being frustrated by the Ruby to being frustrated by the Python. And there was no really clear point, although the point at which I really married myself to Ruby was when I built Destroy All Software's site, and that is a Rails app. And at that point I said, this app is going to exist for years. This is a long-term company. I'm marrying myself to it. And that's the point where I stopped using Python for little one-off shell scripts or stuff like that. And at this point, I go to Ruby first, even if I think I might be faster in Python, just because I want to make sure that I've got my brain in one language at a time.
Okay. That makes sense. Now, I want to dig in a little bit more on just in general what you think. How do I phrase this? Let me back up. So Peep Code, you did the video, and it's the only screencast that I found that had a double black diamond, which meant like harder than hard or more genius than genius. And so I'm a little curious as to what you do to kind of get to that double black diamond level.
Hmm. Well, it's a complex question, right? And it's hard to judge yourself. Mm-hmm. But there are some things that I think contribute to that. For one thing, I just happen to be very dexterous. I type very fast, and for some reason, I can type very fast and talk at normal speed at the same time, which a lot of people seem to be unable to do. And I don't think that's... I'm hesitant to even say that in public because I don't want to sound like I'm saying I'm so smart. I think that different people's brains just work in a slightly different way, and it's not, you know, it's just I happen to be able to talk and type at the same time, which makes me a natural screencaster. There's also the fact that I am incredibly impatient. I'm so impatient. I have no tolerance for anything that does not work exactly perfectly all the time. I can slog through it, and that's what I do when people are paying me money to build software. But when I'm on my own time, I will fix all the little annoyances. And that leads to seeing all the dark corners of your tools, seeing the ways that the different tools can interact, learning about the alternative tools. This is why I know Emacs quite well, and I know Vim quite well, and I know Mercurial quite well, and Git quite well, et cetera, et cetera. Because I'm always bouncing from thing to thing, and that gives you a perspective that you're not going to have if you are only using, you know, Ruby, Git, Vim forever. You miss such a huge part of the software world by doing that.
Right.
So I think, I mean, those are some of the things that I think contribute to the double black diamond difficulty. But so some of it's emulatable and some of it's not. If you can't type and talk, you're not going to be able to screencast at that speed. Or you're going to have to dub over, and then it's not as, it doesn't feel as sort of fast with the same flow.
And are there good resources that people can go to learn these things? Because, I mean, I don't think there's any central location for learning how to use Git or Vim or anything. You know, what recommendations do you have for some of these tools?
It's unfortunate. It's... like the docs for these things are really not designed to be learned from. It's all reference style, which is the Unix tradition. I learned Emacs by working in an office with someone who was a proficient Emacs user. And that was my first real editor. Before that, it was like Notepad and Visual Studio, neither of which are real text editors. So having a person is number one, absolutely. Preferably someone you're working with every day. Aside from that, I think screencasts are a great medium for this that is quite untapped at this point, which is, of course, one of the reasons I'm doing it, because I think it's not only just a commercial opportunity, but it's a great way for us to start sharing the way that we use our tools and cutting down that 10-year Vim learning curve to 1 year to become a very proficient Vim user. So there's things like Vimcasts. That's a free screencast on Vim. A lot of people like that. I don't know if there's an equivalent for Emacs, but there probably is because it's the other editor. There's also, I know there are screencasts. There's a screencast site on Git that's in the same style, but I can't remember what it's called. I know there's a site called Git Ready, which I think is by Nick Waranto, Qrush. It's his site. And That's quite good. I don't think it's published anymore, but there's a huge, you know, couple years of back catalog there, and that's a great resource for understanding all the ways that you should use Git's crazy complicated interface to do very powerful things.
That makes sense. I'm looking up the Git screencast. It says Gitcasts. It's the first one that came up.
Could be. I sort of Git by fire, so I didn't ever... I think I learned it before the screencast thing was really popular.
Yeah, I worked in a few shops that's what they were using, so, you know, I just picked it up. And before that, I was using Subversion, and so Git was a huge breath of fresh air for me.
It was
like, oh man, I don't have to think about this, I can just use it. But there are so many things that, you know, even I haven't really dug into and would like to learn to do better. So, yeah, that's definitely interesting. You bring up text editors, and I want to bring this up not because I necessarily believe in IDEs, but I'm a little curious as to what your take is on it, because every so often somebody will come to me and ask me why I'm not using an IDE, and usually for me, my answer is that it gets in my way, and that, you know, I kind of break down, you know, what gets in my way, but I'm a little curious as to, you know, why you use a text editor over an IDE that has all the tools built in.
Right. Well, there are a couple answers. The sort of narcissistic answer is that for most refactorings, for example, I can do it faster in Vim than most people can do it in their IDE.
Uh-huh.
I have consciously chosen to optimize my text editing speed of basic text editing over sort of building up this giant mass of editing tools, which I could have done. You know, I could have turned Vim into an IDE or died trying, more likely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the narcissistic answer. The more practical answer is I don't think that the tools are that great. Mm-hmm. Things like a lot of refactorings are not computational possibilities in a dynamic language because you don't know what's calling what. You don't know whether it will break something. Of course, you've got tests and all that, but one of the great things about automated refactorings is you can do them and not run your test. Right? In Eclipse, if you do most or all of the refactorings, you don't have to run your tests afterwards because you know that they're structural transformations that work with the guarantees that the language gives you to be safe all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And without that guarantee, it seems to me like a lot of the value is gone. Sufficiently advanced dynamic code is going to have dynamic calling that is not amenable to static analysis of the type that's required for automated refactorings. So I said this was the practical answer, but actually that was a quite theoretical answer. I think the more practical answer is I have not seen an editor that is good enough by my standards as an editor and also has that stuff. Right. It's got to be modal like Vim. It's got to have very advanced text editing like Vim does. It's got to start in less than 100 milliseconds. It's got to be in the command line. I do not use graphical editors. So it's a whole combination of complaints, I guess.
Interesting. So have you done anything like Vim Golf or any of these other challenges? Or
I have not. You know, there's a funny story about Vim Golf, which is one of my good friends, Brian Beck, was working on a site called Vim Golf. And it was up and working. It was a Django app, actually. And as he was ready to release it, that whoever made Vim Golf bought the domain and released Vim Golf. So,
oh no!
So I have like a personal vendetta against Vim Golf to some extent because he beat Brian to the punch by like a couple days.
Oh, that's funny.
But I have not really looked at it because I've always found. Sort of gamey things like that, just uninteresting. Not like I think they're stupid or bad. Mm-hmm. I just personally have never been, they've never grabbed me. I'm much more interested in just building real software extremely sort of proficiently. I like having great control. If you watch my hands when I'm typing, I'm not just typing, I actually make, like when I hit the return key at the end of writing a new spec, it's different than when I hit it when I'm just banging out new lines. It's like a little flourish that I do, which really weird, but I really love turning the act of writing code in the long term into sort of feeling like a performance for yourself, I guess, is mm-hmm. the best way to describe it. And I think stuff like that is lost when you turn it into a numerical competition. Like who can type the fewest characters? Typing few characters is important, but I really like the whole package of building software.
Right, that makes sense. I think one benefit for me, of course, I'm still learning Vim, and so one benefit for me is that it shows the next 20 or 30 solutions, so I can look ahead and see what what the guy did that was better than mine, and figure out what those tricks are. I mean, there have been a few tricks that I've picked up where it's literally saved me minutes of backspacing. You know,
mm-hmm.
where I get on a line and I do a CT and then a character, like a quote or a close paren, and, you know, it cuts everything out and puts it in insert mode so that I'm just good to go. And I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, I didn't have to go all the way over there and then backspace it out. And then, you know, it really, really handy stuff like that. And so that's why I've been liking it. But
it's a great resource for that, yeah. Right? Just seeing, because that's the problem with these things is you don't get exposed to the other ways to do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to discover that. So I think Vim Golf is probably actually a really great way to discover that, just like screencasts are.
Right. Yeah, and I definitely need to check out some of these Vimcasts and things like that. I've had a few people point me that way, and I just, you know, I get so busy with what I'm doing that I just haven't had a chance. But
yeah,
I want to dig into Destroy All Software, because it's not just a screencast service. I mean, some of the stuff in there is rather advanced. It's interesting stuff. And so I'm a little curious as to how you decide what to put in there and what you're trying to accomplish as far as what your subscribers get out of it.
Right. As far as choosing topics, it's a fairly random process. I do have a user voice tab on the site where people submit topics they'd like to hear about. But I only take maybe half of them from there, because a lot of times during the week before, the 2 weeks before, I will become aware of something that I've never talked about, that I know how to talk about, and that people aren't talking about. Those are sort of the three criteria. So for example, I think the latest one was about doing very quick and easy performance tests. And it's just a method I've used that people don't tend to talk about. At least I haven't seen anyone talk about. And so I said, you know, last Monday when I started recording, maybe I'll talk about that. I spend half an hour trying it out. If it works, I do the screencast 7 or 8 times, and eventually I get a final version. Other weeks, it's, you know, what's the top rated suggestion on user voice, and so that is what people want to hear, and then I do that. As far as what I expect people to get out of it, a lot of it is what we've been talking about, sort of learning the details of these tools, things that are not documented, especially the way that they go together. I try to focus a lot on that. I start a lot of screencasts at the terminal, and then the first thing I do is run Vim, and I'm going back and forth the whole time, because I want people to see how it all fits together to build software, not just, you know, oh, you're in Vim, here's how to do stuff. Oh, you're at the terminal, here's how to do stuff, because that it doesn't do service to the complexity of the process of building software and how all these things go together. So that's probably the number one thing. But there's an important second, which is just that there are a lot of advanced topics that people don't have any way to learn unless they have a person who knows it and they can talk to them. And this is stuff like more advanced topics in object-oriented design. It is really hard to learn that. If you Google object-oriented design, you are not going to find good resources. you really have to know someone or know the very few good things that are out there. And so I really want to sort of commoditize that. It's not free, of course. It does cost a little money. But I want to lower that bar from I have a person next to me to I give, you know, Destroy All Software $9.
Now, I'm a little curious, too. We've been talking a lot about how you build software. So why did you call the site Destroy All Software?
The phrase Destroy All Software just popped into my head about maybe a year and a half ago, and I just snatched the domain up because it seemed like something I would want to use. Like I think I mentioned before, I get frustrated. I'm easily frustrated. If you watch my Twitter stream, it's a lot of complaining. There's no word I can use to make it sound better. I do complain. It's almost never complaint in anger. I like doing this despite how frustrating it is, but my nature is that I'm always frustrated. And so for years I've been, when people ask me for a title for, you know, a conference or a contract even, I've been putting creator and destroyer of software for my title. And so I decided to take the destroy side of that because I happen to have the domain, and that's where it came from.
Interesting. All right. Well, you were at RailsConf this last week. How was that? I didn't get to make it.
I was not registered for RailsConf proper. I was only registered for BoConf, which is the sort of fun conference side. And to be honest, RailsConf was kind of a bust for me. I stayed out way too late doing things that are not very productive, like drinking in a bar with other programmers where we're not talking about software. And I sleep a lot, so I would get there at like 2 p.m. and I basically just blew it, which is a good learning experience for me, and you should heed my mistake and not stay out late and show up at 2 p.m. to the conference.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, interesting. All right. Well, I love having these conversations because I really do get a lot out of them, and it's just been packed with information that I now need to go and capitalize on. I've also been looking at doing something similar to Destroy All Software, except maybe more focused on Ruby or Rails development, and you know, and leave some of the other stuff, you know, for other people to cover. What recommendations do you have for somebody who's looking to do something like Destroy All Software?
Don't do it. It's a bad idea. It's bad for the market. I think there are a lot of people thinking about it. I think Brian Lyles has mentioned the possibility. Avdi Grimm just today was talking about it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Uncle Bob's doing his. I'm doing mine. I can't even think. I know there are other people. I think we're seeing an explosion. And I would say you definitely want to make sure that you're good at screencasting first. And that's sort of hard to do. And the only way you can do it is make screencasts and put them out there and see how they go. Mm-hmm. So I did maybe 5 or 6 free screencasts over the course of a year before I started Destroy All Software. And the first one was quite bad. And then all the ones after that had quite good responses and a lot of hits. And so that sort of validated for me my own ability to do it. Mm-hmm. But that's very important because you don't want to get into it and realize it's a horrible struggle and you can barely churn out good content.
Yeah.
The other thing has actually just slipped my mind as I was saying the first thing. Get a good mic. That's always $100 for a decent USB mic is all you need to start. That's all I have right now, actually. Don't ever use your built-in mic. They're terrible.
Yeah. I'm a little more of a snob. I actually have a $200 XLR mic that goes into my mixer over here. And
yeah, you've got me beat. I've got about $200 worth of gear total, but the mic itself is about one. But even a $100 mic is good enough that the room I'm in right now is the limiting factor of my sound quality. So,
yeah, that's really true. I have a friend that he was doing video chats with Pat Maddox and a few other people out there in the community, and yeah, he was complaining about some of the audio quality, and I said, look, I said, I've got this USB mic that I don't use anymore, and so I sold it to him for like $50 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was really interesting because the tweet the next day was, man, you don't realize how bad your audio quality is until you get a decent mic. And
yeah,
it's really true. And yeah, he was using just the built-in whatever on his webcam, and it was bad.
The other thing is the room matters just as much as the mic. And if you want to hear how bad the room is, get a thick blanket or a comforter or something, put it over your head and the mic, say a sentence, throw it off, say the sentence, and you'll hear, it'll be night and day because you'll hear all the echoes without the blanket, and the blanket deadens them all. So if you really want to be even more depressed about your mic, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, I don't want to deter anybody from trying to contribute because, you know, even if you don't have stellar sound quality, you have, you know, if people can understand what you're saying and you can get the point across and not lose your audience in the middle of your screencast, then you're contributing something of value. Somebody will find the value in it.
Yep.
And, so just jump in and get involved.
Totally agree. I'd love to see more screencasting. I'm so glad that it's taking off as a medium. And I think the only two things are make sure you can get the narrative down, right? You're not losing people in the middle. And make sure that the topic you're talking about is something that people are going to be interested in and it's not already saturated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the hard one, I think, is finding those topics. And I guess the way that I found mine is I looked back at, you know, several years of going to lots of user groups and conferences and just talking to people, and I thought about, like, what do they ask me questions about the most?
Yep.
And it's exactly the topics that are on Destroy All Software. It's test-driven development, object-oriented design, Vim, using Unix effectively, Git. Those are the big five. And so if you can identify those topics for yourself, what are you good at that people draw knowledge from you actively about? Then you have your topic for your screencasts.
That makes a lot of sense. That really does. And, you know, I never really thought about it that way. I just do whatever, you know, is striking my fancy. But, yeah, it does make a lot of sense. You know, that, yeah, if you think about, okay, well, what are people asking me about? Yeah, you can usually boil it down to a few things and focus on that.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I really, really appreciate it. And it's like I said, it's been so enlightening. I'm going to have to go back and listen to this and, you know, take better notes as far as, oh, I need to focus on this and I need to learn this and I need to do this. Before we get off, I do want to let people know that they can find you. Your blog is blog.extracheese.org.
That's true. It's sort of been laying unposted to while I've been doing Destroy All Software, but
right.
That is my blog.
And definitely you can go find him at destroyallsoftware.com. Your screencasts are $9 a month.
That's right.
And
released once per week.
Yep. And I was looking at some of them, and some of them look like they're actually a little over my head, but something that I probably ought to learn. So,
I definitely have subscribers who tell me they watch them twice.
Yeah,
and I'm happy about that. My goal is density. I want the top end of my users to watch them once, and I want a lot of users who do have to watch them twice, or skip back, or slow them down even. So,
yeah,
totally fine with me.
it's interesting too, because I mean, I listen to podcasts all day, and a lot of times there will be content that, you know, I just kind of let blow by or wash over me because I'm either not interested or I already know.
Mm-hmm.
And then every once in a while, I have to skip back. You know, I have to hit that back button that skips back 30 seconds so I can hear it again, or so that I can write down the website or whatever it is, because that's something that really makes a difference. And that's when you know you've got something good. Is where you're going, hold on, wait a minute, I need to make sure that I get that. And yeah, so if that's the way your screencasts are, then you're hitting it right on the money. But yeah, and then the other thing that, or the other place that people can find you is on Twitter. It's Gary Bernhardt.
Yep.
I'll let you spell that so I don't kill it.
It is GaryBernhardt.
All right. Oh, one other thing that I wanted to ask, and this is because Corey recommended you talk to me. How involved are you in the software craftsmanship movement?
I'm peripheral, I would say. I'm not very active. I actually was one of the people in the conversation that created code retreats.
Uh-huh.
That was at the CodeMash conference outside Cleveland. So I'm connected in that way. I've been to several code retreats, probably like 7 or 8. I've co-facilitated 2 of them, or maybe 3 now, 2 or 3. So I'm involved with Code Retreat, which is one of the pieces of the craftsmanship movement, where we do a day of intense, focused practice, doing the same thing over and over again and deleting the code each time to understand how we're doing it. Outside of that, I've not been very involved actively. I'm committed to it. I'm committed to the movement, and it is, you know, it aligns perfectly with my relationship to the software profession. But unfortunately, I haven't been very active yet.
Right. Well, doing things like screencasts, I can vouch for how much time that takes. It really does take up a lot of time, but
yeah.
You know, ultimately, it's interesting and it's worth it, I think. So. All right. Well, thanks for coming on to the podcast, and hopefully we'll get this up on Thursday, and people can download it and enjoy it and play it back, because I know I'm going to have to, so.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
All right, bye.
Thanks again, Gary, for coming on to the podcast. I really appreciate it. We're going to wrap things up here. I just want to acknowledge our sponsor again, New Relic, newrelic.com. They really are just a terrific tool, as I said before. I also want to remind you to go check out Gary's stuff at destroyallsoftware.com. Go read his blog, all that stuff. There's some terrific stuff there, just great topics. And it seems like he really knows his stuff, you know. Well, you heard him. He does. He knows his stuff. So go check him out. You can also get a hold of me at 801-367-6164. If you have any suggestions for the show, you can email me, Chuck at teachmetocode.com. If you go to teachmetocode.com and click on request a topic, you can also put in the names and of people that you think I should get a hold of. If you have some way of getting a hold of them, hopefully you can also email me and let me know their contact details so that I can get a hold of them and find out what they're all about. I also want to let you know you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/CMAXW. That's CMAXW. And, you know, finally, go leave a review in iTunes. I know that there are a lot of people listening to this through iTunes and other podcatchers. And any reviews that you can do, especially if you're overseas, if you're not in the U.S., I really appreciate those because they show up in the iTunes store. The iTunes store is kind of segregated by language and by country. So if you leave a review in the U.K. or Australia or, you know, if you're in Latin America or something, then those reviews show up for those listeners and they really help the show out. So anyway, that's about it. I just want to close and remind you that writing the code is the easy part.